This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there, welcome to the program. In the politics of Israel, the power behind the throne isn't necessarily Jewish. In fact, 4 million of Israel's strongest supporters are American evangelical and Pentecostal Christians. The Christian Zionist movement influences presidents and prime ministers, and now it's under the microscope. I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report, and that story's soon. India's ruling nationalist party, the BJP, is using a controversy over a sacred temple to boost support in a southern state where it's normally very weak. The country's Supreme Court recently lifted a ban on women of childbearing age visiting the Sabarimala temple in Kerala. Now that's triggered a backlash, as the foreign editor of the Hindustan Times, Pramit Pal Chowdhury, explains.
Well, the temple is a temple in the southern state of Kerala dedicated to a popular god there, Ayyappan. There are many Ayyappan temples in Kerala. This one is a little unusual in fact that at certain points of the year, it says that women who are of basically menstruating or childbearing age are not allowed. And even men who arrive there have to be celibate for 41 days, because Ayyappan in this temple represents universal celibacy. So as a consequence, it has this unusual restriction on who is allowed to visit that temple. Now, some activists have then asked that why this is discriminatory against women in particular, and took it to the Supreme Court, which then ruled that, in fact, yes, this was a violation in a 4-1 judgment, that the Supreme Court said this was violative of the Indian Constitution and said that women would have unlimited access to the temple.
Pramit, in this vast ecology of religion in India, one of the world's great religious marketplaces, what is so significant about this particular temple, though? Why has it attracted so much controversy?
Well, it's a good question, and it's not always easy to figure out why it's one specific temple. There are almost, I would say, temples all across India have all sorts of restrictions on them. There are temples that do not allow people who have taken religious vows. There are temples that do not allow men in. There are temples that do not allow women. There are temples that do not allow non-Hindus. There are temples that do not allow certain types of caste. This ayat, the Sabarimala temple, interestingly enough, while it has a restriction on women, allows Muslims and Christians to come and pray there. So, yes, as you said, there's an enormous mosaic of variety, all built around all sorts of curious local traditions that are sort of lost in the past. I think what was interesting in this case, and one of the reasons it's become such an important case, is simply politics. Kerala and India as a whole are going for national elections sometime early next year. Kerala is an unusual state in India in the fact that the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, which is normally described as a Hindu nationalist party, has very little presence there. It is the two rival parties of the Congress, which is a sort of left of center, and the communists, which are by definition leftist. But underneath them socially, they represent two different social coalitions. The communists are actually a Hindu caste coalition, while the Congress represents largely a Muslim Christian combination. So the BJP has been looking for a wedge issue, if you wish, that would allow them to break the caste, the Hindu coalition that backs the communists. And one of the arguments is that they have now moved in on this issue, imported a number of activists from around India, and are using the Sabarimala temple to embarrass the communist regime, which presently rules in Kerala. Yeah.
Interestingly, though, Pramit, I understand that many of the protesters who want to uphold the ban on women of childbearing or menstruating age from entering the temple are women themselves.
Oh, yes. The local population there, which is largely of a tribal background, and a lot of the local Keralite Ayyappan devotees, are very clear that since Ayyappan represents this universal celibacy concept, and this is a tradition that goes back many centuries, this basically violates the principle of which Ayyappan represents in this temple. And therefore, if you break the celibacy requirement, then automatically the temple has basically lost its sanctity. Mm. So yes, there's a lot of support in Kerala, and even the communist regime there, though, while saying obviously that it will follow the Supreme Court's judgment, is already preparing the grounds for a review petition to make the argument that the Supreme Court in this case has overstepped itself and asked for a new bench to review the issue.
And similarly, Pramit, is it true that some of the liberals who have supported the Supreme Court's ruling are in fact appealing for the rights of women Hindus to make their own prayers? So they're appealing on a religious freedom basis as well.
Yeah, the balance in the question here is thing. And a lot of constitutional lawyers have stepped in and made this argument and said, look, the Constitution of India, partly because of this incredible mosaic of religious beliefs in India, has always been very clear that, yes, there is a Bill of Rights. There are universal values. The Bill of Rights, if you may know, is adopted from the Irish Constitution in India. But it also says that communities, religious communities in India, have the right to have certain exceptions to this rule. So the Catholic Church in India does not have women priests. The Islamic communities in India obviously have certain restrictions of their own, as well as various, literally thousands of different Hindu groups. So the question has always been, is the balance between these two, at times obviously conflicting positions in the Constitution. Now, the strict interpreters of the Constitution have come in and said the Supreme Court overstepped. Worship, the judgment twists and turns and says Ayyappan devotees are not actually a Hindu community of their own, so therefore they don't get the provision, the protection that all religious communities get in India to be allowed to have exceptions to the Bill of Rights. And hence, therefore, that the judgment is it goes a little too far. Obviously, those who believe in the Bill of Rights is what dominates here, and that this was clearly discriminatory against women in particular, argue that no, the Supreme Court has done the right thing. Ultimately, India has to move in the direction of a universal value structure regarding, as you mentioned, the equality of women and their rights regarding men. Mm.
And just finally, Pramit, how much of this debate over the Sabarimala temple has been a proxy debate about the entire caste system in India? Because I notice a fairly distinguished Indian jurist, she was or law professor, she was saying, look, denying women entry to this temple amounts to untouchability, the reference to the Dalit caste, and untouchability has been outlawed in the Indian constitution for the entire history of modern India. So is this a bigger proxy war?
Not really in this case, because the Ayyappan temple has no caste barrier. In other words, anybody of any caste is allowed to worship at the temple. The only restrictions, as I've mentioned, are about the issue of the celibacy requirement. And even then, those are only in certain sacred points. The temple, as I've mentioned, allows non-Hindus, which is relatively unusual for older Hindu temples, to freely worship. And in fact, it's a Christian singer, Yeshudas, who does the annual Ayyappan festival's music. He opens it. And his name means literally slave of Christ. So on that front, no, I don't think. I think then that in this case, it's really more of a metaphor, which feminist activists have made in India, and a broader argument, which is that women, to some extent among conservative Hindus, are treated almost as a separate caste within the Hindu structure, even though obviously formally they aren't.
That's Pramit Pal Chowdhury. He's one of India's top journalists. He's with the Hindustan Times, and you're with Andrew West. When Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu falls on hard times, be it corruption charges at home or diplomatic isolation abroad, he depends on his most faithful followers. But they're not all Jewish. His biggest block of support is arguably the 4 million-strong community in the United States called Christian Zionists. And they've emboldened Netanyahu to fight the West's nuclear deal with Iran and attempts to start a Palestinian state. Well, Sean Durbin is the author of the new book, Righteous Gentiles.
Christian Zionism is a relatively recent term, and it basically is a label that gets used to describe Christians who believe that the modern state of Israel is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. They saw the creation of the state of Israel in 1948, and particularly its expansion in 1967 to encompass Jerusalem, what they describe as sort of signs of the times. So for them, the creation of modern state of Israel meant that within their lifetime, they expected Jesus to return. In its sort of more contemporary context, they tend to sort of define or understand Christian support as kind of a divine duty, essentially. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that although certainly not all evangelicals or all Christians identify with Christian Zionism, and many see it as very heretical, those that do identify with it, they want to have the kind of authoritative idea of what Christianity is. And for them, that means being a Christian Zionist and supporting Israel, and particularly in sort of its expansionist endeavors.
You can see, Sean, why it would be a seductive form of theology to some on the right in Israel. But is Christian Zionism actually sympathetic to the tenets of Judaism as a faith?
Well, in a lot of ways, and that's a lot of the kind of criticism that gets leveled at them, is that they don't really care about Judaism, or they still essentially see Christianity as the true religion, whereas Judaism has been superseded. But in fact, they are in many respects sympathetic to Judaism, and they sort of, the way that they kind of frame this is to sort of say, well, if it weren't for Judaism, then Christianity wouldn't exist. One of the things that they tend to emphasize is this sort of debt that Christianity owes to Judaism. I guess part of this, in a theological sense, is that Christian Zionists still maintain that for them, God isn't finished with Jews. He has an eternal covenant with them. And it's through that eternal covenant that Christians are sort of able to have this relationship with God, and therefore they're able to kind of maintain their truth claims about the world.
Is it, though, a genuine theology, or is Christian Zionism really a political ideology?
That's an interesting question, and I think it's one that gets sort of asked a lot. It's clearly political, but for them, they claim, no, this is not political, this is religious. What I sort of argue and demonstrate by focusing especially on their rhetoric is the way that they reconstitute political activities as acts of religious devotion.
In what way? Because that's fascinating. What political activities do they dress up as religion?
One of the ways that they do that is by describing what they do, their political activities, by relating them to biblical stories. A big focus of Christians United for Israel over the last 8 or 9 years has been focusing on Iran, and they're very opposed to the Iran nuclear deal that the Obama administration made. So they're very excited about the Trump administration's overturning of that deal. The reason that Iran kind of works in this sense and their political lobbying against the Iran nuclear deal is that they use the Book of Esther from the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament as Christians tend to refer to it, as a kind of typological example of the way ordinary people get used by God to do things to kind of further his plans in the world. The Book of Esther takes place in ancient Persia, which is associated with modern Iran. There's a woman there who is not Jewish. She gets asked to warn the Jewish people in the Book of Esther that there's great danger for them. And what happens in that book is that the person who has kind of plotted this plan to kill all of the Jews in ancient Persia ends up being killed in the exact same way that he had planned for the Jews to actually be killed. And Christian Zionists cite this example as basically a manifestation of a text in the book of Genesis, which is Genesis 12:3, which is probably the most cited piece of scripture that Christian Zionists use. And in Genesis 12:3, it says, "I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you, I will curse." And so contemporary Christian Zionists like Hagee often cite this and say, this is exactly the situation that's going on with Iran, and we are the kind of contemporary Esthers in this sense. They basically redefine their political activities as acts of God, so they become God's instruments and are acting on his behalf.
Right. Are they nakedly partisan? I know Bibi Netanyahu draws a lot of comfort from the Christian Zionists. Do they know what they're doing in terms of their partisanship?
I mean, they absolutely love Benjamin Netanyahu. I can't prove this, and so I write about it as a kind of form of myth that is useful in their storytelling of their origins. But one of the things that got talked about a lot during my research and going to CUFI, which is the acronym for Christians United for Israel, going to their events, is that they claim that actually the organization started at the behest of Netanyahu, who asked Hagee, you know, oh, you go around the world having these pro-Israel events, but it doesn't have any political effect, so you need to start a political organization that can actually make a difference. In many ways, they essentially trail the policies and the ideas that he has, and so it would be interesting to see if an Israeli prime minister had very different views about what he wanted to do, if he wanted to, for example, not have complete control over Jerusalem or something like that, how they would respond. But in that sense, I mean, they're kind of just following the line of the Israeli right wing, and they like that.
Your book is built around the figure of John Hagee, who is a megachurch pastor in the United States. Just tell us who he is and this organization over which he presides.
Hagee's been around for a while, and he is a relatively controversial figure, but he certainly gained a much greater hearing with the Trump administration. Christians United for Israel was established in 2006, and it's kind of been growing since then. And the reason that they claim that it's growing is because they're doing God's work, and therefore God's favor is falling upon them.
And what sort of numbers are we talking about?
They claim a membership of 4 million. How that works is unclear because, I mean, I'm a member of their email list. So if that is what counts as being a member, then obviously I'm counted among those numbers as well. But every year they have what's called a Washington Summit, which is an annual multi-day event. A few thousand members will go to Washington, D.C., and they have this kind of conference which goes for a few days. And typically it involves right-wing think tanks, other kind of very hawkish speakers explaining the importance of Israel. Those particular speakers don't speak specifically about religious significance. The religious significance kind of comes from sermons, other things in their church. But then these events are punctuated at the end by a kind of very formal lobbying of congressional representatives and senators, et cetera, on the kind of things that they talked about. So it's essentially kind of a rallying event. And then these members will go with a very unified voice and tell their senators and congressmen what they think. And it is always a very hawkish kind of point of view.
So just finally, Sean, another way in which Christian Zionists seek to connect, as it were, and this happens in Australia, I understand, is through tourism. What are these tours that the Christian Zionists market?
Yeah, that's right. The Christian Zionists engage in tours of Israel. I participated in one, and I've actually got a chapter coming out in a really fantastic edited volume, which is specifically about myth-making and identity formation on Christian Zionist tours of Israel. But essentially what they do is that they're very kind of well-planned tours that take kind of lay Christians around and then define Israel and give them this picture of Israel that sort of really represents Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy and as a demonstration that God's word remains true, that the Bible is accurate in all of what it says, and essentially that Israel has a divine right to the land, and that's kind of uses selective information and particular stops to explain this. And it just kind of really bolsters the support, and it sort of makes it a bit more real, I suppose, because they're there. And essentially they see a thriving, vibrant Israel, and that is then represented as, again, the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, of claims that are made in the Bible about how Israel will be sort of thriving again and children will be running in the street and this kind of thing. Essentially, modern Israel almost becomes more significant than thinking about it in its historical context of walking where Jesus walked kind of thing, which is something that interests Christian tourists to Israel as well. But for Christian Zionists who see the state as, you know, an ongoing sort of vessel of God's divine will, just its sheer existence and engagement with Israelis becomes something of a kind of religious experience itself.
Great to talk to you. Fascinating stuff. Sean Durbin is the editor of Righteous Gentiles, Religion, Identity and Myth in John Hagee's Christians United for Israel. Sean, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
And you can hear a longer version of that at the Religion and Ethics Report website. On Monday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison and Labor leader Bill Shorten apologised on behalf of the nation to children who were sexually abused in churches, sporting and community groups, and state institutions. The recent Royal Commission found that 60% of institutional abuse occurred in the churches. It's the Catholic Church's internal laws that are now under scrutiny. Because church law has often frustrated efforts to report abuse to police and shielded perpetrators. So can this law be reformed so that it helps rather than hinders? Belgian senator and law professor Rick Torfs was in Australia recently for a conference, and he says that urgent reforms must start with independent church tribunals to deal with abusers. And he's speaking with RN's Noel Debien.
What we truly need are independent courts, tribunals. Now, today, they are not independent in the church. The bishop, even if he's not judging all the cases himself, is the ultimate responsible person for the functioning of the tribunal. He can always intervene, and that's a bad thing. Instead of that, I think, we need tribunals with lay people in it who have a great expertise in canon law, maybe also a few with enough secular law expertise to know what all is about in the legal field in general, and they should be totally independent from the diocese or from the Pope on the universal level, and they should be able to look carefully if a bishop is not implementing Roman guidelines or Roman norms with regard to the control of priests who are committing crimes or who are committing sexual abuse. Well, then that tribunal should be able to do something about it. And today the bishop is not controlled. The only person who can judge the bishop is the Pope, but not the tribunal locally.
You were rector of Leuven University, one of the world's greatest universities in terms of Catholic tradition in particular, but one of its oldest and greatest universities. Your specialty is law. You've also sat in the European Parliament as a senator, and you're suggesting, I think, that when we look at the Catholic Church in local area, whether that's Melbourne or Adelaide or Sydney or Trier or Antwerp or wherever, we would see a bishop, but we would also now see judges and a judicial system which has the power to investigate the bishop inside the church? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, inside the church. For a tribunal on the level of the church province, for instance, I could imagine that for Australia as a whole, it would be perfectly possible to organize a tribunal with independent judges and to find enough, let's say, talent or qualified people to take care of that. Independent judges, if possible, lay people, men and women, who can assess, control the legal character of episcopal acts.
Now, this is fascinating in one sense, because in Australia there is an organisation called Towards Healing, which was for most of Australia, and there's a thing called the Melbourne Response. These were internal church responses grappling with sex abuse within the church, but the bishop was not able to be investigated under either of these systems because the bishop was above the system. You're suggesting that a judge of the church, not unlike a Sharia court, by the way, in an Islamic system, or a Jewish court, by the way, in Israel, like a Beth Din, you're suggesting a similar system, and we do have them because we have marriage tribunals in Australia already.
Yeah.
But you're suggesting that this would be possible to ensure that canon law itself was actually being applied correctly? Is that what you're
Absolutely.
Suggesting?
The court could or should react by, for instance, declaring null what he does, or by transmitting, that's also a possibility, a dossier to Rome. But I think it's perfectly possible to establish such a system with independent tribunals and then ultimately leaving, if necessary, penalties to the Pope.
Now, Professor Torfs, you served as a senator on the European Parliament, so you've worked in the secular realm as well as being governor of an important university. Why should anybody trust the church to set up tribunals to investigate its own law when we have courts already in Australia, or you have courts already in Belgium, and you have courts across Europe? Why would anybody give the church that ability, or agree that it could exist in parallel to our legal systems, is my question.
In case crimes have been committed, crimes also according to secular law, through the law of Australia, then of course that law of Australia has to be implemented also on clerics, including bishops. That's an obvious thing. But at the same time, of course, there are also consequences of those crimes that cannot be assessed or judged by Australian judges because they are typically connected with the life of the church. For instance, should a cleric, a priest, be laicized?
Lose their position totally.
Yeah,
yes.
Lose the position, etc., as a priest. Should someone be excommunicated from the church?
These are spiritual penalties, in fact, that you're talking about.
Yeah,
here,
those
yes.
are penalties, of course, that cannot be imposed by the state because, well, there is a separation also between church and state, and there is religious freedom. So, of course, the church has to accept penalties as pronounced by state tribunals, but at the same time, additional measures have to be taken within the church. And in that regard, it is necessary that the church system continues to exist and, of course, to function better than it has been doing up until now.
You're suggesting this would be as well as the civil penalties, I think?
Yeah, of course. It's also important whether or not a perpetrator, for instance, after coming back from jail, can have new functions in the church or not. And that's ultimately something that the church has to decide upon.
You, in your paper, when you spoke to the conference in Melbourne, noted the recommendation 16.9 of the Royal Commission that the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference should request the Holy See to amend the 1983 Code of Canon Law to create a new canon or series of canons related to child sexual abuse. How likely is it that the Code of Canon Law will be amended in accordance with what the Royal Commission has suggested?
Well, it's of course not an obvious thing. It's not because, well, the Royal Commission in Australia asks for a change that Rome will do that. That's clear. Yet, on the other hand, it's also true that the Royal Commission doesn't stand alone. We have had various reports in many countries, including the recent report in Pennsylvania, but there were troubles in Ireland, in the Netherlands, also in Belgium, almost everywhere. And so altogether, I think, church leaders internationally start feeling the urgent need to change the system to some extent. But I think that gradually more and more people, including people in the Vatican, are aware of the fact that they have to change the universal system. There can be two reasons for that. In case they are good people, they will do that for the benefit of the church and of the people.
To improve it.
And faithful, yeah. And if they are bad and wicked people, they will do it to save their own position.
To save themselves.
Yeah, but maybe a combination of both arguments can be tremendously helpful to achieve a good result.
That's Belgian Senator and Law Professor Rick Torfs, who was in Australia recently, and he was speaking there with RN's Noel Debien. And that's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. Next week, my ABC colleague Stan Grant joins me for a discussion with the controversial British author David Goodhart, and we look at the big questions of migration, identity and nationalism. That is the program, though, for this week. You can find us at the RN website, the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Thanks to Munda Tadias and Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.